think when you're fed up making excuses and you feel like you need a bit of an external accountability support, someone that's done it before, then those are the kind of people that tend to book a call with me.
It's very easy to make an excuse not to do something, isn't it?
I mean, I honestly, I wasted 6 years, probably 2015, 2020, no, 2014, 2020, making every excuse you could think of. And it was all fear-driven. I wrote down in my journal, beginning of 2020, nobody's coming for you. Nobody's going to build this business for you. You have to be the one that goes and does it. So I made all these excuses about waiting for a co-founder or a perfect idea. Iterated 3 or 4 ideas. April that year, so 3 months later, had built Prod MBA, validated it, and got that to profitability by July, so sort of 4 months after starting. But I only had that breakthrough once I'd, you know, basically gone, that's enough. Enough excuses, time to actually take control of this situation.
Welcome to the Product Development Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Wakeling. In this episode, I'm joined by Henry Latham, who is the founder and lead mentor at Prod MBA, as well as founder of Break Free, his latest venture focusing on helping senior product people launch their own micro businesses. Earlier this year, he also released a manifesto targeting senior product people entitled A New Path for Product Leaders Tired of the Corporate Grind, which is the main focus of today's conversation. So Henry, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks Adam for having me.
Do you want to briefly kind of go through your sort of highlights in your product career, get to know you a bit better?
Yeah, sure. So I started my first business about 10 years ago, a company called Backtracker. I was traveling by myself in Brazil and had a lot of time to think. So I sort of came up with this idea for how to backpack better, sort of connecting friends and, you know, following other people's trips and pinning cool stuff to do. So that was my first exposure in the product world and business world, and quickly made every mistake you could possibly think of, from, you know, decisions driven by ego, to failure to understand strategy and like basic economics, that, oh, we need to maybe make some money from this thing. But luckily got into an accelerator, had some investment and some really good mentors around. But 2 years into that business, it failed. And really since that point, I was driven by the goal of saying, okay, well, you know, that business failed. How can I now build a business that succeeds? And that took me on a journey to work in Brazil, Portugal, Germany, and in the UK. Different product roles, from consulting to founding to working for other companies, and published a book in 2019 called Why Your Startup Failed. 2020 then started a business called Prod MBA, and that time really did a micro business, so solo founded, no funding, aiming for profitability very early on. Took that business to profitability within 4 months, have been running that for 4 years, and just recently pivoted to, yeah, start another business that I felt was more aligned with my own interests, my own unique value, and also that really the direction I'm seeing, in fact, in the product world.
So you obviously, Prod MBA is the previous business or existing business. Is that something you said pivot there? Is that essentially you are sort of leaving that in the past and this is the new
focus? Well, yeah,
focus,
I mean, we can talk about that. So so for some context there, in January this year, as every year, I will do a bit of an audit, right? So read over my journals from the year, look at my calendar and sort of see what things energize me, what things de-energize me. And about that time, if you remember, there was a survey, I'm sure you would have seen this, there's a survey that came out on job dissatisfaction. Specifically, it was a survey on the careers where people are looking to change job most. Top of that list was senior product managers. I think it was around 60-something% looking to change job. Not necessarily career, but changing job. Now, you know, we could talk about, is that a good survey? Like, what was the actual, you know, source of it, et cetera. But what it did is crystallized a thought that I had had based on, you know, I've had probably over 600 conversations with product people live, right? 30-minute calls at least. I've had 300 students come through Prod MBA that I coach 3 to 4 hours on live calls, plus all of the workshops, plus all the videos they watch. So a lot of interaction with product people. And I'd noticed a trend where people were job hopping, and they still are job hopping, right? So they're going, I'm not very happy in my current product role. I'm going to go to another company and hopefully that one is more fulfilling, rewarding, fill in the blank. Why is this happening? Because based on my, you know, anecdotal, but again, 500, 600 people, experience. Plus, if you know, Marty Kagan will say this, 90%+ of companies are not product led, right? They are not doing product as we read about it in the books, right? Doing our discovery and strategy and running experiments. And we've got an awesome boss who's like super supportive of us doing all that stuff. We don't have that. We're you know, product people are glorified project managers in most cases. So I felt that, you know, Product MBA, the promise was around helping product managers get into product leadership, and implicitly that by doing so, you're going to have more, you know, more freedom. It's going to be more rewarding. You're going to have a seat at the table, higher salary, etc. I didn't feel that I could make that promise any longer in good conscience, just by looking at the stats, by looking at the conversations that I had had. And that's not to say that all product roles are bad or it's the wrong career path, but I just want, you know, make sure we can be, have an honest conversation about what is actually, and if you're going to say to someone, hey, product management's a really good career, I think you should get into it. Let's be really honest to them. I always was, but I, you know, I don't think the industry is about what should you expect. You know, you're probably not going to be doing all this cool product stuff you're reading about. You're probably going to be doing project management, stakeholder management, right? A lot of meetings as well. So come January 2024 this year, I sort of said to myself, well, I think that I want to take a different direction to solve the real problem, right? Being that product people want to move up the career ladder. And I helped them do that for 4 years. But why are they doing it? Most of them are doing that because they want to start their own business, right? They want freedom of time. They want fulfillment. They want to do something they're really engaged in. And I felt that carrying up the product career ladder is not the way to do that in most cases. I think the better way, in fact, is going to be starting your own business. And I think we're now in a world where that is, there's no reason to not start a business other than fear holding you back. It's not a question of resources or skill in the modern age.
Mm. You make a great point about the difference between the theory, the books, and the reality of what's happening in the businesses. You know, you can read Olson's Lean Product Playbook and Kagan's work and Transformed Inspired. Fantastic theoretical books, and certainly Olson's case is very practical, but actually doing that in the business and having that leadership provide the environment to actually facilitate that can be very difficult if you're not product led.
And I think, you know, really good, a good litmus test for whether you should listen to someone or not on LinkedIn is which books are they recommending? I find the really effective product people, they're recommending things like, you know, books around skills of influence, around storytelling, about the hard thing about hard things, right? Resilience and the psychological challenges versus the, you know, here's the paradise, here's the ideal of starting a product business. And also, by the way, most authors do not say that it's, you know, Marty Kagan does not say that the world's awesome and every startup, you know, every sort of company is product led. But it's too easy to sort of lean on the ideal rather than just say, like, what's the reality and how do we be pragmatic and adapt to that? Or get out and start your own business as well.
Well, we'll obviously get onto that part in a little bit. But yeah, just kind of building that background and the context of where we are at the moment. I've got the manifesto in front of me and I'd like to pick out a few lines and we'll go through them and you can kind of expand a bit in terms of your thought process behind that particular part. And so right at the beginning, you say that senior product people are fed up and they don't want to be doing what they're doing for the next 30 years. So can you paint a bit more of the picture around, you know, corporate product leadership right now, as well as a bit more generally, you know, the current state of product management that kind of underpins that leadership?
Good. So yeah, let's start with the first one. I don't think it's just corporate, by the way. I mean, I use that wording, but I think it is, I think there's a general myth around product management that I touched upon this before, that the more senior you get, the more freedom, fulfillment, etc. you will find. Because, you know, when you're just starting out, you know, PM or junior or whatever, you probably look at senior, well, you do look at senior people and go, oh my God, wow, awesome. They're like, they're so smart and they know about strategy and like they're speaking to the CEO all the time. And we go, wow, that sounds awesome. And the reality is that it actually becomes a bit of a trap because the more senior we get, the more meetings we're going to have, the more expectations, the more stakeholder management we find ourselves doing. So we sort of get more stuck in that world. And also what we tend to see is conversations I have is people are ultimately the one that they, not always, but right, the kind of people that I engage with that are obviously attracted to what I'm doing now, they go, well, I want to get maybe like 5 more years experience and then do my own things. So they sort of get in this, going up this ladder that may be the wrong ladder to go up. And I find that the more they go up the career ladder, the more they do things like, what we call hedonistic adaptation. So they earn more money, but they also spend more money to sort of justify where they're at. What does that mean? Suddenly they're spending 10K a month and the idea of changing career or starting their own business is like, how am I going to find something that's going to pay me 10K a month, for example? And I think, broadening out that to trends around product leadership, I think that's been a thing, right? That's not something new. I think the two big things is, one, the macroeconomic situation. So companies have smaller budgets. What are they doing? Firstly, it means that they're less likely to take perceived risks. Perceived risk is running a product, basically going, yeah, we're not sure, which is what product led's about. We're not sure that these ideas are going to work, so we're going to test them out and sort of see what happens. That's actually quite a lot scarier than going, here's our roadmap. It's definitely going to work. Let's just build it and sort of close our eyes and fingers crossed and sort of ignore what's actually happening there. So there's that. What does that mean? It means that there's less autonomy. Or investors have said to founders, like, you've got to do ABC. That's what we want to see to tie you over for another year. So product leadership sort of pulled out of the decision-making equation. The second thing is obviously related to that, layoffs. Whether you were laid off or not, many product leaders have suddenly turned around and gone, oh, okay, that job that felt really secure is maybe not so secure. So I should be looking at something else, whether that's starting your own podcast, whether it's starting your own business, whatever it might be. I think many are eyes on the door, because also, rightly so, they've realized, well, I'm a commodity, right? If the company doesn't need me or want me one day, I'm out the door.
It reminds a bit of the thing as well around when people transition from management roles to leadership roles. Very different skill sets. And I wonder, going through that product path, you go from individual contributor, product manager, senior product manager, and then get to those senior product roles, which are leadership based rather than execution, less of project management responsibilities and strategy and managing sort of other people. Do you think beyond just people being fed up, is that potentially also part of they don't have the skill sets at the leadership roles because they come from that product management background? Do you think there's anything sort of there at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, that's where Product B was positioned to solve, is that there is a big barrier between senior PM and, whatever it's, director of product, depends on the company. Less so than going from PM to senior PM, because as you say, the skill set shifts quite a lot. So suddenly it's things like coaching, it's things like storytelling, it's things like understanding of business strategy, of product strategy. And if you've just focused on execution, or you've done a bit of discovery that feeds into execution, completely different skill sets. And not only the difference, how do you get those skills without being able to practice them slowly so that you can sort of get to the point where you feel like, okay, yeah, I'm ready to be a leader? I think the second thing is the implications are a lot bigger the more senior you are, right? So, if you get product strategy wrong, that's going to potentially cost millions to the company, tens of millions, if not, because you're defining a certain direction for multiple product teams to take, for example. And then I think the second part of that is also companies value far less the skills of product leadership than they do in practice the skills of a product manager, because it's these intangible things like the coaching, like the facilitation. And as I said, in many companies, really product leaders are there to it's like a military structure, right? It's pass on the orders of the person above them. So, what is meant to be this sort of autonomous role and about like incentivizing teams and setting up autonomous structures is just not really there. And in fact,
so you mentioned around speaking to many, many product people as part of MBA, I think 600 or so you mentioned. In those conversations and to where your conclusions are now in terms of people being very fed up, what sort of things were you hearing during those conversations? Some examples, and what were the through lines in those conversations?
It really comes down to unmet expectations. I think if you said to someone, hey, Adam, so look, ideally, you're going to be doing this stuff, strategy, discovery, experimentation, maybe, you know, learning how to work with data and analytics. Adam, look, here's what you're going to be doing. It's going to be awesome. Go into product. And then you don't do any of those things. You are understandably disappointed because your expectations are so far off the reality. And I think that was the problem, not necessarily by, well, no, that's not true. Many companies put on their job description, you know, hey, we want someone that's autonomous, that's a decision maker. And, you know, here's this nice list of things, skills and responsibilities. And then they get in, it's like, oh, yeah, so you're not actually going to do that stuff. You're going to be doing project management. Mm. So I think it's unmet expectations. I think it's good. I respect companies that go, you know, the job listing is for a project manager. Fair enough. And some people love that, by the way. Some people love organizing and sort of getting people in a room. And not for me, but it's for other people. Mm. It's what they like doing. So unmet expectations. The second big thing, in fact, is lack of support from leadership. So, you know, you have many leaders that, particularly in product more so than other areas, that have been parachuted in from like business or design or tech. And they've got no idea how to support a product person's career. And understandably, because they haven't been down that path. No one's told them how to do it. So you get PMs, senior PMs, even more senior that are going, well, like, where am I getting that support and that growth to improve myself, to deliver better results? And they're not being provided that at work. And I think thirdly is that this more recent thing around layoffs and general cuts that just suddenly make them realize, well, my company doesn't care about me. They don't want me to be autonomous. They don't want me to, you know, deliver, maximize results. There's sort of an apathy, I think, that comes with that.
Mm. So, I mean, on the flip side of the layoffs, obviously you've got on the other side, the promotions people get and actually when they are kept on at companies. And that is the second point you mentioned in the manifesto as well, which is promotions mean more stress, more meetings and less fulfillment. And I wanted to unpack that a bit. But before we talk about the stress and the meetings, what is fulfillment to you? What is less fulfillment?
Yeah, good question. So when I was 21-ish, running Backtracker, right, startup, had investment, you know, my ego was telling me fulfillment equals being on the front cover of Forbes. It is, you know, making millions, traveling the world, right, glamour and all of that. I wouldn't say glamour because I've never been particularly money driven, but you know, being known as a sort of a cutting edge startup founder, as I think probably happens with everyone as they get older. When I started Prod MBA, for example, which I think is really my only like big success business, right? I've done quite a few businesses, but that's the one that really stands out. Rather than just going, okay, I've got an idea, I'm going to test it out, which most of us, that's what most people do. I paused and said, okay, before I even think of ideas, like what kind of business do I want to build? What's that lens, those constraints that I'm going to set for myself? And I said, well, I don't want to raise investment because I don't want to traipse around pitching to investors. And basically, rather than thinking of the customer, thinking of what the investor might want with the product, I wanted to solo found because I wanted to be able to move quickly, not be stuck in meetings all the time with founders. I wanted to be aligned on the product vision. That's easiest when it's just you. Third thing I said, I wanted to keep it small and not hire people. And I never did with Pronomia. I, you know, automated a lot, a few freelancers, but I didn't want to have a big team because again, I didn't want to have all of that overhead as I grew the business. And then the fourth thing was saying, how do I get to actual financial freedom in some form? That only comes from aiming for profitability very, very early. So rather than a startup, you know, you could be part of a startup that's got millions of users, you build it for 5-6 years, and suddenly you either it fails or you can't make money from it, or you exit and actually you're bottom of the list of getting cashed out, which has happened a lot last year with down rounds. So recapping, sorry, I set those constraints in place so that I could get what I felt was fulfillment. And that personally is freedom of time. It's the ability to, you know, I went surfing 10 a.m. on a Monday morning today. It's spending time with my son, my wife, dogs, friends, family, these kind of things. And just not being a slave to feeling like I'm doing stuff that doesn't really matter. So not being stuck in meetings or working on, you know, features that I don't want. And I found myself doing that, by the way, when I was freelancing or some roles before. And I said, look, I never want to do that. I want to, you know, make sure I'm doing things that I think matter, or doing things that, you know, hobbies, things that I get a real joy from.
Yeah, I wonder if the COVID times as well opened people's eyes to, I want to spend more time with my family, friends. I want to be at home more. I want to spend some more time with my dog. I don't know, all sorts of things. And I guess micro-business is very appealing.
Time to reflect.
Mm, yeah.
And that was another key factor in my decision making with launching Break Free was by working from home, they suddenly had more time both during the day and not commuting to suddenly go, okay, what do I want from life? Right, having that sort of quiet period by yourself that many people actually avoided or just never found for themselves when they were, you know, going into London every day, commuting or wherever you're based.
Mm. So the other side of the stress and more meetings, I mean, it is the product leadership. I mean, I'm speaking from a product manager perspective, so I'm not exposed yet to really that senior product leadership position. So we obviously painted a bit earlier on that product leadership kind of perspective, but where does it come from, the stress in particular? Is it unlike other roles in the business? Is it a unique sort of stress to the product role? What is that specifically, would you say?
There's two types of stress that are really important to differentiate. So there's a stress when we feel where things are outside. That's that not nice feeling of stress when things are outside of our control and we feel maybe unable to resolve it. And then we have this the Greek term for eustress, like EU stress. It's that feeling of, you know, that sort of endorphiny positive. We're feeling like we're moving in the right direction. There's some pressure on us, for example, but it's feels like we're now within control. We're sort of moving towards resolution of something. So I had that, for example, with Break Free. I did eight or nine pre-sales. I didn't build a solution. I took a deposit from people and then went, okay, well, I need to give myself now a month to build this solution. So I was up at 5 a.m. like working very hard to make sure this solution was ready. That was a good level of stress because I knew what I needed to do and was able to get it done. So I think when I talk about stress as a negative, it's really that, you know, feeling like you're just being leadership passed around stakeholders, talking about things that don't ultimately matter, not having autonomy. That's the thing to avoid. And again, that is not to say that's always the case. There are some really lucky people, very talented people that are able to create an environment where they are able to manage upwards, manage downwards, and move the needle, right? Become more product-led and great. Congrats to you. Awesome work. It's really hard to do. So it's not always the case, but most product leaders are finding themselves basically like a glorified project manager plus glorified messenger, right? Bouncing between different people.
Yes. Yeah, so you mentioned around the freedom of time aspect earlier. You say in the next part of the manifesto, the inconvenient truth is that you cannot achieve this working for somebody else. Nor can you really achieve this working in product because of the hands-on management heavy nature of the job. So to kind of invert it, who is the right people to move into those senior product roles and stay in them and don't launch their own businesses?
Yeah. And that's, again, an important question. And there are people in this group. I think the first is if you genuinely believe in the purpose in terms of the impact that that company either promises to deliver or does deliver, in fact, then as with everything, you should stick with it. You should stick with it and you should push for change and really try and make things happen. So there's that. You know, if you try and try and try and nothing really changes, then you can have a conversation with yourself about, okay, maybe I, you know, try and have that impact or deliver that mission somewhere else, whether it's your own business or another business. The second one is the character of the person. You know, I speak to people that, for example, I'm relatively introverted. Right? I train myself to be extroverted, but I like spending time by myself. But, you know, I will have I'll run a workshop for 20 people. I'll need an hour to like really decompress after that. So for me, it's particularly draining being in a role where I'm having lots of meetings and sort of trying to move all the pieces. And linked to that as well is personal stuff. Like, what are you interested in? Like, for example, I like product. I find it really interesting, but I'm not, you know, I see people on podcasts and like LinkedIn who are just like, they will happily talk about the nuances of story mapping for 8 hours and they love it and they're super passionate about it. And I'm like, I just don't really care about it. You know, it's not my thing. So you have to, you know, you have to really love the craft. And I actually realized only last year that I love business. I like business building. That's what I'm passionate about. I like product, super interested, but I'm not passionate about it. And you know, you're always going to, whatever you are passionate about, you're just going to put in way more work than anyone else. You know, you're going to ultimately rise to the top of whatever that interest is.
Mm. Yeah. Also, I think there's very few product people I would expect who are working on a product that is something that they really, really want to work on. It's more sort of, that's a good role for that type of product management I'm into, B2B, SaaS, whatever else it could be, but exactly, it's not your passion.
Looking at these surface level things, which is salary, it's kind of responsibilities you're doing. It's like, does it fit with my previous experience? Rather than actually going, does my previous experience align with what I want long term? I remember a conversation with one of my students. I won't name names, but you know, he had been in fintech for 10 years and done really, really well, but he didn't love fintech. It wasn't his thing. It paid the bills. And I said, well, like, why don't you try something else? He's like, well, I've never really thought about that. You know, it's, we create our own cage for ourselves sometimes. These narrative, you know, a narrative of, yeah, you know, I'm a fintech PM. That's all I can do. Or, you know, for me as an entrepreneur, it was always things like, until I realized a narrative of, well, I need a co-founder to start the next business, or an investment, or, you know, I don't know how to do sales, so I can't just start something myself. So all of these sort of narratives that really just limit us.
I wonder if it's also a bit of a challenge in the job market as well, because a lot of companies in the job description say, we want someone with experience on this type of product before as well. And it's very pigeonholing people into that little niche that they struggle to go across disciplines and types of business.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it makes sense, right? We naturally have to be a little bit lazy with selection. You know, it's harder to go, I'm going to take a risk on, you know, I've got a fintech role. I'm going to take a risk on Adam, who's, you know, been a founder only or worked as a PM in B2C or something completely different. It's just harder to do that.
So the people who should launch their own micro businesses, what does that segment look like?
Good question. I'm just thinking of conversations I've had this week. I mean, look, the kind of points that come up is fed up with this cycle of job hopping, very common. I spoke, one of my clients is based in Denmark, extremely experienced guy, head of product. He says, look, I just job hop every 2 years. Money is not an issue. I don't know what he's on, but it's, you know, probably 150K pretty comfortably. He just job hops and is good at what he does as well. That's the funny thing. He's really good at what he does and everyone rewards him for it and goes, you know, he's an awesome product guy. He's not fulfilled by that. He feels, you know, unfulfilled by doing that. It's usually people that have a strong motivation to free up time as well. So, you know, for me, it's things like being able to get outdoors during the day, surf, to, you know, spend time with my son, for example. You know, I had one student literally cried on a sales call because she was so motivated about not having to send her daughter off to childcare for 10 hours a day and not going back to a full-time job to be able to sort of be a more active parent. So I think it's that having a strong motivation about, like, what are you going to fill the time with? Because other, you're never going to make that change. You know, if you can complain about meetings, but then, you know, what are you doing with that time? You're doing something that really, you know, you get real fulfillment and enjoyment from. Third thing, I think there's a character, right? So I would consider myself to be, what's the phrase for it? I can't remember the exact phrase. It's like disagreeable, but in a nice way. So, you know, if I think, I've always had this problem with stakeholder management, but if I think something's wrong and there's lots of evidence, it's right, like, I'm going to say it's wrong. I'm not going to go, okay, yeah, maybe we'll do that later. So what does that mean? It means I will inevitably come into conflict with stakeholders. So I learned that pretty early on. Okay, yeah, maybe working for people, at least in an employee capacity, not the right thing. Not the right thing for me. And I think other people, and that, by the way, is not to say that I know everything I'm right about. It's just quite simply that I'm better if I'm able to operate by myself or with a small team, for example. I think there's a sort of personality type where you are used to doing your own thing, you're used to sort of taking action and also sort of being responsible, I think. And that for me always came from obviously like running my first business as a founder. So it's quite hard to sort of found something and go into employment, for example. But better just accept that and do something about it, rather than, you know, you see people just beat themselves up because they're going from role to role, frustrated all the time.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of psychologists agree that disagreeability is probably a trait that lends itself well in the business world in terms of moving up the ladder and being those founders or leadership roles for sure. Yeah, so elsewhere in the manifesto then, you talk about people tend to ask, how can I be a better product manager and leader? But you say the question most senior product people really want answered is this: how can I get better at product to launch my own business? So starting with the first part there before we talk about the actual launching the business part, is there any techniques that you tend to recommend with people as they're maybe rising, they're kind of maybe a brand new senior product manager, let's say, or they're kind of in the sort of lower echelon of that hierarchy? But what is the common advice you give, or is there not really a one size fits all list of things to recommend people?
No, for me, it always comes down to where can you get real world actionable experience? So that if you can get that on the job of testing ideas out, or, you know, defining product strategy and then letting that trickle into your roadmap and seeing what the results are, awesome. But again, most companies are not like that, right? You're sort of just building stuff that you've been told to build and not tracking like what the impact was. So for me, it's quite simply like, go build something. If it's a side project, completely unrelated to work, fine. If it is a side project that could be useful at work, you know, great, awesome. It doesn't matter. Just do something where you're going, you know, who's the target market? What's the problem I'm solving? Can I do discovery calls? What's my value proposition? Is it actually unique? How do I know it's unique? Okay, how do we build something really lean and quick? How do we get validation for that? Just do that in some form. It could be with a, you know, boot camp. It could be with a newsletter that you launch. It could be building an OCO product. Doesn't matter. Just really deeply understanding intellectually, like why differentiation is important, but seeing the impact of pitching a differentiated offer to, let's say, you know, a really unique way to train your dog that you've developed, I don't know, as a hobby. Pitching that and seeing people actually sign up your landing page or pay you money for it, far more effective than, you know, reading about like Blue Ocean strategy and things like that. So yes, you know, you need theory. You need good theory. It's going to help you make better decisions, but you need to be just getting loads of repetitions to build your skill set, your product nuance, your product sense, and confidence as well is a huge one, huge factor.
Yeah, I think there's a big difference between seeing an example in a book and then having your own product there and trying to apply that framework to your product and all the trials and tribulations around that.
And, you know, classic example, and this is a very product management book thing. It's like, just go run experiments. So here's how to do it. What they don't talk about is the psychological side, which is how do you pick yourself up when you test something out and it fails? How do you, you know, how do you know when to pivot when there's no clear answer to that? How do you navigate the sort of social shame that you feel of being excited about an idea and seeing it flop? And that's why I love entrepreneurship. But there's just nowhere to hide. There's no excuses. You can't let your ego blind yourself from certain things. That's, you know, the ultimate arena to learn and grow.
I guess fail fast and learn from that as well in that practical world.
Yeah. Absolutely. So
the second part of that then, the how can I get better at product to launch my own business? So what is it about getting better at product to launch your own business? What does that look like? Is there a framework that you use? I mean, obviously you're launching this Break Free, so is there a kind of structure to that which is applicable to this question?
Yeah, we could talk about the specific structure used for Break Free and really how to validate a business within, you know, 48 hours we do it with. Why is learning product important? I think, well, the things that really stand out to me are, one, a genuine understanding that we need to listen to the customer. Because it's such a cliche, right? Go listen to the customer. What do we mean by that specifically? It means understanding what is the real problem that your customer faces. That's number one. So a very common mistake is product people will focus on, or inexperienced people tend to focus on, what we call a surface level problem. That would be, going, okay, let's say, Adam, I interview you about how you manage your time. You go, yeah, I just need a better calendar app. And I go, great, okay, so bad calendar app or slow calendar app. Whereas when we actually dig down, the deeper level problem is really not about the calendar app. It's about how Adam is managing his time to live a more fulfilled daily life, for example. And then that leads us in very different directions, because it's not about like, how do we make meetings more visible in our calendar? We start thinking about things like, okay, how do we bring in Adam's hobbies and interests and personal goals, for example, into how he's managing his time? So by really understanding problems, we tend to be able to open up our mind to different directions we could take and more effective solutions, because we understand what the real problem is. We're not going, hey, Adam, here's a better calendar app. You go, I don't care about that. Adam, hey, here's something that's going to help you squeeze in everything you want to live a fulfilled life, and you know, not just work meetings, but also your hobbies and date with your girlfriend later, whatever it is. So understanding problems properly. The second thing is understanding of differentiation. That's the key thing. You'd always be able to build something. Not all, you know, most cases, not always at all. You know, building a Tesla car is pretty difficult from scratch. The building stuff, I think, is not actually the hard part. The harder part is coming up with something that people actually want. You know, we live in a world that's got 16 times more products than it did just 10 years ago. What are the implications of that? It means every market is mega competitive, right? There's 50 project management tools where there used to be 3, for example. So by understanding, like, how do we position ourselves? How do we find gaps in the market? How do we understand how to package ourselves and sell and offer to somebody effectively is absolutely fundamental. Because otherwise, you know, you're going to faff around building some solution for a year, 2 years that nobody actually wants. And we can make all the excuses, and product people are very clever, they're very experienced, they're going to make all these clever excuses about why they need to focus on the solution and not do the validation, and why it has to be a digital solution rather than start with something manual or physical basically prevents them and making progress. But that, the fundamental, that principle of understanding differentiation and strategy and the different steps of that are going to make you really effective. Now, I don't think, for example, I don't think an MBA is that important. I think just a basic understanding of business, which is really like, okay, if it's going to cost us X to build this and we're going to get Y revenue from someone, like, does that mean we get to profitability or not? And how many people are in the market? It's really that simple.
I guess if you are a practicing product manager and maybe even a senior product manager, but if you are that project manager, really, you're not really exposed to that stuff that much. It's very...
No, you're not. You're not. Exactly. Yeah. You need to expose yourself to it. And that's why I think working on some sort of side product or business is the best vehicle. And combining that with good theory as well is important.
What you mentioned there sounded very much aligned to sort of Dan Olson's use of that problem space area, which is very much, you know, what are the problems to solve? Peeling back the onion to the root kind of problem that you're trying to tackle, and finding that unique differentiator away from the competitive market where you have to be 10 times better or very disruptive in technologies to find those opportunities. I mean, in terms of trying to get to that product of what I suppose it sits in the top left quadrant of the customer satisfaction and importance matrix that he does, but any quick tips in terms of how you approach that in terms of helping to try and get to the root problems that are opportunities?
Yeah, there's a few things there. So I think the first thing is don't try and reinvent the wheel. Just do one thing way better than somebody else. So Superhuman's a great example, right? Superhuman. Imagine if I said to you, Adam, you've got to build competitor to Gmail. It's going to cost $30 per month. We're going to start it from scratch. Right, so we need to do all the basic functionality of what email should do. You would go, that's completely bonkers. But Superhuman have managed to outcompete Gmail and charge $30, which is 5 or 6 times the price of Gmail, because they were just laser focused on speed. You go on their website, this hasn't changed for 2 years, by the way. We are the fastest email experience ever. The fastest email experience ever. That is all they focus on. That's the core of a good product strategy. We're just really freaking good at fast email. We're going to save you lots of time, because we know, Adam, you're really busy and you're spending 3 hours a day on email, and we're going to reduce that number for you. We're not going to faff around with all these funny filters and other features that you don't really need. So tip one is just do one thing really, really well. And that usually works in a market with one big mature product. Second thing could be looking for Peter Thiel, or this is called like a Thielian secret from Peter Thiel, which is like, what's this one unique way you can look at the problem or unique solution you can come up with that no one else has really thought about or other people think is sort of invaluable? So coming back to that calendar example, I really like a product called Amie.so, Amie.so, because the founder, Dennis, essentially said, okay, we're not building a better calendar. We're really trying to rethink how people manage their time effectively. And that's what's really important, because we understand it's not about, you know, how can my boss book more meetings with me in my calendar? It's actually about how I can block time for the things that really matter to me. So they sort of merged the idea of a to-do list and a calendar in one. So what are we doing now? We're really going back to first principles and trying to say, like, what really is the problem? And is the existing way that's being solved, is that the right way? If we really question it, is that the way it should be? Or for example, like meetings, this idea of having a default 60-minute meeting, like, does that really make sense anymore? You know, with modern tools and modern ways of work. They're really trying to question and discover what that Thielian secret might be. I think the third tip is just go speak to your target market. You know, we say that someone that's had a problem, they've been thinking about this stuff for possibly years, if not decades. And, you know, if you think of weight loss, decades people struggle with this. Don't think you're some genius. Just go speak to them. What are the problems you face? What have you tried to solve it? If I gave you a magic wand, how would you possibly solve this? And then just see, you know, aggregate those, see what the trends are. Use something like Dovetail to do so, to track the results. And then you're going to get some ideas from that.
I like the example, which I heard, I think, in a podcast with the co-creator of the Jobs to be Done framework. And he talked about Milky Way and Snickers bars. And he was saying that, you know, typically the average person would think, well, it fits the same thing. It's a chocolate bar. They're doing the same thing, really. But they have very different problems that they're solving. You know, Milky Way bar is, I don't know, you're upset, you want to cheer yourself up with a bar of chocolate or whatever else it could be. And then Snickers is there as a, you know, you're hungry, you need a substantial meal, and it's basically a meal replacement bar. So actually it's targeting a whole different segment of food products.
Yeah, this is a really important point. We talk about differentiation. Really, positioning is the key concept to understand. I really recommend the book called Positioning, written in the 80s, but really relevant. You know, products are essentially, we put them on these mental, I talk about buckets, we put them in mental buckets. So let's take the sports apparel industry, right? Who owns which bucket? The yoga bucket equals Lululemon. Right? Lululemon is synonymous with yoga apparel. We think of, let's say, like quality, the quality, like performance bucket is Nike and Adidas. We've got two, in fact, in that one. If it's running, it's Asics, New Balance potentially as well. So we need to understand, like, which bucket are we in, so that when our audience thinks of our product, like, what is that gap that we're filling for them? Duracell, great example. What do we think when we think Duracell? Long-lasting battery. That's the gap. They've within the battery market, they've gone after long-lasting. So again, it's finding that sort of one thing that really helps you stand out. And I think the whole concept, the theory of positioning, is something to help you sort of deeply understand that a bit more effectively. Mm.
So to jump back to the kind of the launching a micro business away from the problem solving, the product piece, is there anything else in terms of break free that covers the, you know, the other side of launching a business? And what are the other components to it outside of the solving the right problem, you're doing the right thing in that side?
Yeah. Yeah. So the theory is super simple, right, with starting a business, which is step one, find an acute problem. Right? It's easier if it's acute because people are more willing to try it out and pay you for it. Second thing is define a target market. So what's that very specific niche you can start with? So you can be laser focused. Three is then we do something called a 5-minute business model, which is essentially like back of the napkin, kind of like, can we make money from that? Can we make enough money from this idea? Can you hit what I call your freedom number, which is the money you need per month, pay yourself to quit your job? And usually that's quite low, by the way, for most people when they cut some costs. And then the fourth is, how do we come up with a compelling offer? So something that really stands out to the audience. They go, you know, I'm willing to at least check out the website, if not pay for this thing. Step five is just ask 10 people in your network to pay for it. Right. And we got a 50% hit rate, by the way, with our beta program within the sprint time to make that happen. Theory is really simple. What is hard is the stuff that is not on paper. That is fear. It is fear. You know, everyone's had an idea. It is fear of getting started. So actually going and doing something with this idea you've had. And the second one is fear of rejection. The fear of rejection is the never going and asking someone from the target market, are you actually going to pay for this in some form? And those are the two things, you know, with the unique format of Breakthrough. I always say to people, you've got skills, you've got experience, you're super smart. That's not what's holding you back. It's fear and it's this sort of self-sabotage. And these clever, you know, super logical, rational excuses you're going to come up with, but those are ultimately fear. So the model is a sprint format where I'm on the calls with them, like coaching them and also cracking the whip a bit, right? There's accountability there so that you can't come with bullshit excuses and say, well, I didn't test it out because of this. It's like, no, go test it with the market and see what they say, because anything else is just overthinking. Anything else is an action.
So how long is the, I suppose, can I call it a course? Or how was the proper description of Breakthrough?
Yeah, so Breakthrough is a sprint format where essentially you can come in with zero idea, and we're going to go from idea, develop an idea, and then go through to generate, get at least one sale over either a 48-hour format. So you take 2 days off work, or we'll do it on a weekend, go through all the way through to revenue, doing one right now, in fact, or 5 days. So you can do it around a normal work week. Mm. As well.
Gotcha. So it's very rapid. It's not a kind of long drawn out 5-6 months of
no. And again, that's deliberate. It's a deliberate constraint so that you can't overthink it. And you can just, you know, again, I remind students of their goal, because I had this today earlier. Someone will go, oh, but I'm not passionate about this business idea, or I just see some challenges with scale. Really easy to not do anything about it, whereas I can look, You're not wedded to this business idea forever. Test it out. See where it goes for a few weeks, a few months. And you'll probably find you love it, you're really passionate about it. And also I always remind people, like, why are you doing this? Why are you committing your hard-earned money to pay me to help you on this journey? Because you want to quit your job, you want to spend more time with your family, fill in the blank, right? Whatever it is, that coming back to that question of fulfillment, whatever fulfillment is to you, you're not getting that right now. And we're taking action to change that. Trust the process, and let's see where it ultimately leads. Mm.
So, the very last part with the manifesto I've written down here is 95% of you will not find those rare, truly product-led, autonomy-first businesses that allow you to thrive. Instead, 95% of you must take the hard but empowering path of launching your own business, which in today's economic conditions means bootstrapped solopreneurship. Many of you probably don't have the will. So, as a kind of towards the end of this podcast and to wrap up, I think just the idea of not having the will, I'd like to talk about a bit. So what is that? What is truly required on that side?
Yeah, you can't engineer persistence. I can help people paint a vision for themselves and how we're going to get there. But persistence is the I'd say maybe the only essential ingredient, the one thing you cannot not have to be successful as an entrepreneur, because it's persistence in speaking to your target market. It's persistence in iterating your offer. It's persistence in pitching it. You make one sale. How do you get to 5 sales? How do you scale acquisition? How do you evolve the product? There's a whole, I'm 10 years into entrepreneurship. Persistence is still there as something you have to sort of keep momentum up with. What does it come down for people? It's really, you got to the point where you need to make change. Because if not, you're going to go, well, I'll just do one more year, or I'm going to wait for a slight salary increase to build my savings, or if I change role next year, maybe I'm going to find that really fulfilling role. So I think when you're fed up making excuses and you feel like you need a bit of an external accountability support, someone that's done it before, then those are the kind of people that tend to book a call with me.
It's very easy to make an excuse not to do something, isn't it? It's.
I mean, yeah. I honestly, I wasted 6 years, probably 2015, 2020, no, 2014, 2020, making every excuse you could think of. And it was all fear driven. And in fact, I remember I wrote down in my journal beginning of 2020, nobody's coming for you. Nobody's going to build this business for you. You have to be the one that goes and does it. So I made all these excuses about waiting for a co-founder or a perfect idea. Iterated 3 or 4 ideas, April that year. So 3 months later, had built Prod MBA, validated it and got that to profitability by July. So sort of 4 months after starting, but only had that breakthrough once I'd basically gone, that's enough excuses, time to actually take control of this situation.
So to bring everything together, what key takeaways would you give people to really think about after this podcast and invite them to really question whether they should be launching their own micro business or not?
Yeah, I think everyone has ideas. So I want to start with, end with something actionable. A business is not a failure. It's not something you're, again, wedded to, committed to. Just an experiment, run an experiment. Come up with some problems that you face, your friends and family face. Go speak to 5 people that have that problem. If you see there's something there, go back to them and say, look, hey, Adam, I think there's something really exciting that I want to be working on in the dog treat space, right? Here's pitch something that you think could be compelling to them and see, would you be willing to put a deposit down? Would you be willing to pay for it? Get that first sale. That's all the momentum you're going to need. And I think most people know if they want to start a business. So I'm not going to add anything there. I think it's more just realize that your excuses are excuses.
Awesome. Well, I think hopefully some people will be inspired to either start their own business or start thinking about it and I guess check out Breakfree as well. Can you give a bit more details about where they can find that online?
Yeah, sure. Go to breakfreesprints.com. We're going to be publicly launching in a month. So currently doing the beta program. And follow me on LinkedIn as well. So Henry Latham, I'm posting every day, Monday to Friday, on LinkedIn as well. So that's the best place to find me.
Great. Henry, thank you so much for spending the time with us and sharing your insights. And wish you all the best for Breakfree. And thanks for joining.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam.
Thanks for listening to the Product Development Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to leave a follow on your preferred podcast platform and a like on YouTube. Subscribe for more episodes and look forward to seeing you in the next episode.